welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I am your host, Spencer, and with me is a talented young man. He can play street ball, he can play legit, referee, boring basketball, and some colleges are taking a look at him right now.
Yeah, my father treated me like shit. But hey, that's a story for another day. Oh, okay, that's also not true, especially considering my father is, what's his name, Tamura? Yeah, never mind. Hey, it's Joel.
Yeah, this episode is the first half of the 1998 pairing, which is He Got Game, which is a Spike Lee film, and instead of Shakespeare in Love, we're going to do Eternity in a Day, the Cannes winner from that year. By Theo something. I can't remember his name offhand. But,
Andropolis. They're essentially the same movie.
Can you say it again? I guess I haven't named yet.
Theo Andropolis, right?
Yeah, I think so. And with that, joining us is John Cribbs of Pink Smoke and the Redbeard episode in season one. And the.
Welcome back, John.
Hey guys, I was, you know, I came over to the high and low offices, but all the furniture was gone, and there was a for sale sign in front. I wondered where the heck you guys went.
Oh yeah, we moved to New York. We are office buddies with 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah, we're in the Stewbed area.
Yeah, Spike doesn't know we're doing this. Mm-hmm.
And he never will.
Yeah. So, why did you pick He Got Game?
I think He Got Game is a really interesting film. I think, looking at his whole filmography, for me, it's kind of a mixture of one of his best films and one of his worst films in a lot of ways. I think some of his best tendencies are on display and some of his worst are on display. So it's one that, like, I feel like I love it. But I don't know if I would honestly call it one of my all-time favorites. But it's a film that I like to think about a lot, and I think it has certain scenes that are better than anything that he's ever done, like just or as good as like his greatest moments. So it's just a film that I always enjoy kind of revisiting and talking about.
What's your history with Spike? Like, how did you first hear about him? Do you like Spike?
I do.
Mixed on him?
Oh, of course. No, I think Spike is one of the greatest filmmakers of his generation. I think he is somebody who effortlessly knows how to make things cinematic, you know, just understands the art of cinema more than a lot of his contemporaries, so that even though he doesn't always use the best judgment, I think, in terms of what he's trying to say in his films, he is unquestionably a master filmmaker. And of course, my first impression of him growing up in the 90s was Morris Blackman on the Michael Jordan commercials, the Nike commercials. So that personality, I guess that also kind of informs my appreciation of He Got Game, is that I first knew about Spike because of basketball. Not just the Nike commercials, but him being a constant presence at all the Knicks games, of course.
Are you a Knicks fan?
I'm not a Knicks fan, but I'm a lifelong Bulls fan because I grew up. I grew up in Chicago. It's not true at all. I spent some time outside of Indianapolis and in the early '90s, so I got to see Jordan play every time he came into town, and I saw the All Star Larry's game with Jordan and Magic and like all the best players, and so you see Jordan play, and it's just impossible not to love the Bulls. So I've always rooted for them, even though I'm kind of more of a half fan of the NBA in general these days. But
well, NBA is better than NFL.
It is in some ways, yeah. It's the same as baseball, though. It's just, to me, there's just too many games in the season. It's too much time investment for me these days. So it kind of suffers for that. But when the playoffs roll around, you know, I always watch them.
Okay,
when it gets down to it.
Yeah, I can respect you liking the Bulls for that reason.
Exactly, yeah.
I grew up in Sixers country, but I didn't really care about NBA until college, and the first few games I saw were Celtics, so Spike can listen to this if you ever hear this. But I've been a Celtics fan since college. But which is kind of blasphemy on Spike Lee podcast, I'm fully aware.
Yeah, you're going to get excommunicated like Marcus did when he tried to shake his hand with the Red Sox hat on.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, that makes sense for Spike, though. I wouldn't expect anything else from him.
Oh, it's very on-brand, absolutely. That sums it up perfectly, yeah.
So, Joel, were you familiar with He Got Game before this episode?
Other than the title, no, I can't say I was. Didn't really know what it was. You can assume it's about basketball. I think depending on the cover you're looking at, has some sort of basketball imagery going on there. But I did not know what I was getting into. It's a good movie. You know, I think it might be too long.
I think you can say that most Spike movies.
Yeah, it's something we're going to run into.
Few things we're going to run into.
Yeah. You kind of lose track of who the movie's actually supposed to be about, kind of, and it's got the, like, as I was messaging you before, it's got his becoming incredibly more apparent problems with women characters as we move along.
What are you talking about? He writes women perfectly.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Enough said.
But I first heard of this because when I followed the Celtics, Ray Allen was on the team, and he used to be one of my favorite NBA players until he went to the Miami Heat, and he's a goddamn traitor.
Then fuck him.
Yeah, play with LeBron, get her a ring. Yeah, I get it, but I don't like it. But so I've been aware of this for a little bit. I just never kind of got around to it. I think honestly because he went to the Heat, and I'm still a little upset by that.
But don't hold his acting against him because of that. Yeah.
His acting, it varies, I feel.
I mean, how do you guys feel about that? Like, him as an actor?
Oh, Joel, did you know who Ray Allen was?
No, I didn't. I knew he was not an actor, but I didn't know of him before we started watching, or before we watched the movie. But my basketball knowledge is Los Angeles Lakers, Jordan in the 80s, and you got me.
Oh. So you didn't recognize the other NBA players in the movie?
Well, I mean, some people. You're going to recognize Charles Barkley. You're going to recognize, obviously, there was Michael Jordan for 1 second. Like, all right, Spike, you get literally a second of my time. And it has to be in between when I'm walking away from whatever I was doing. And, a couple of people. But
well, what's really crazy is he got Reggie Miller to cameo in this film, since they are heated rivals on the court. Famously.
Oh, yeah, I think was this before or after the choke?
This was after the 94 playoff game, where everyone blamed Spike for inspiring Reggie to score, what was it, something like 16 points in the last 20 seconds, something ridiculous.
It was, wow. I think, 7 points in the last 6 seconds, 9 seconds,
yeah,
to win the game.
Yeah.
It's insane, and yeah, it definitely is worth watching on YouTube. And it's literally like 10 seconds of like, oh, wow, anything is possible.
Yeah, you'll never see a better example of a fan getting his mouth shut up than by like that performance. But I'm sure that's, it was a great playful rivalry, and that's probably why he could get Reggie to make a brief cameo in this film. So it's good to know that it wasn't, you know, there was no bad blood between them. But for Ray Allen, though, I'm going to go all in on this. Just say I think Ray Allen is great in this movie. I mean, obviously lacking any, you know, classical training as a performer, I think that it's one of the best performances by an athlete in a film. With the short list being, you know, what, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in The Stand, Vinnie Jones in Midnight Meat Train, Jim Brown as the Fireball in The Running Man. And possibly the
Jim Brown. Jim Brown can be good in some stuff. It depends on, you know, what he's working with.
Oh yeah, well, first of all,
Vinnie Jones was an athlete.
Yeah, he played soccer.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said he was an athlete. No, I'm just kidding.
but yeah, he but wasn't, for a one-off. No, yeah, for a one-off performance, I think he's only rivaled by Wilt Chamberlain playing Bombada in Conan the Destroyer.
I guess.
And
so.
No disrespect to my boy Brian Bosworth in Stone Cold, which of course is a classic.
Okay, yes, there you go. That is the best athlete turn actor. You know, you can't beat Stone Cold.
You really can't, but I think Ray Allen, you know, gives him a run for his money in this. I think.
Okay, he is better than
yeah, that. I think he's just emotionally present in a way that's really surprising playing this part. I don't think the film would work if Ray Allen was anything less than really good. So just the fact that he kind of carries this film and holds his own against Denzel, you know, for me is really impressive. So it was supposed to be Kobe originally. Spike wanted to get Kobe.
If that happened, I would not like the movie.
but definitely I would nominate him for all-time best non-comedic performance by a professional athlete in a one-off performance. Mm-hmm. If such an award exists. A lot should be given to Susan Batson, who was the acting coach on a lot of Spike's films, Get on the Bus, Girl 6, Summer Sam, Bamboozled. She was the one who coached Ray during the film, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of his performance is credited to her.
Yeah, I like that you said not comedic, because I would have said, what about the Naked Gun movies?
Exactly. Which, what about Shazam? Kazam. Not yeah. Shazam, Kazam.
Yeah. But you were saying, John, about this being a case of Spike's worst and best. I feel like Bamboozled is also a great example of this is the worst Spike tendencies and also the best.
I could definitely see why you would say that. I think that Damon Wayans' performance in Bamboozled is like a real huge hurdle to get over in that film. Personally, I love Bamboozled, though. I think it's one of his best films. I really dig that movie. But certainly, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, Bamboozled is a little more difficult, where this is definitely a more of a crowd pleaser in certain regards, and definitely more mainstream, where like Bamboozled, the subject matter in Bamboozled just makes it kind of more niche, and I get why people didn't flock to it when it came out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. People didn't flock to this one either. This one kind of falls between the cracks of his filmography, I feel, because it kind of came and went in 98. But to me, I don't know, it feels like Spike's superhero movie, just in terms of the theme of being, you know, what does someone with special powers owe to the rest of the world? You know? Like, the very first shot of the movie is Farmland USA, the dude playing basketball. It could be frickin' Smallville, it could be Superman, you know? And the fact that Ray Allen's character is named Jesus, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, we're obviously supposed to think of him as this guy who is the best at what he does, and then the whole movie isn't about him doing that, it's about people wanting things from him and expecting things from him. And him having to kind of go through this. And again, Ray Allen, you know, kind of taking on that emotional toll, you know, throughout the film, I think it's one of the best things about it. And then, you know, Denzel getting involved in it, too, doesn't hurt.
Of the Denzel movies I've seen, this might be, like, one of his best performances, like, period. Like, compared to, like, Malcolm X, which is kind of him. Like, he does a lot in Malcolm X, but here, like, he definitely is more, he feels more active. Because, like, Malcolm X, there's a whole, like, it turns to a paranoid thriller of, like, you know, he knows he's going to get killed at some point. You know, like, where this is, like, Denzel is this kind of firing on all cylinders, and he's, you know, kind of a shitty dad. And he tries his best to make up, but, like, there's never, like, a cheesy, overly dramatic moment or whatever. Just kind of like, yeah, he kind of, he's trying, but you know, it's a little more realistic with like their father-son relationship and just how complicated it is.
Oh, I agree. I think this movie does not fall into sentimentality at all. At least in terms of their relationship, you know, I think that it keeps it real in a way that's, you know, very satisfying, that It could easily just be, you know, this story about bonding or coming back together, but it doesn't really let Denzel off the hook at any point. You know, he still kind of has the same problems at the end of the movie, and he's right back where he started, right at the exact same place we saw him shoot hoops, you know, behind the walls of the penitentiary. So, yeah, I agree. It's not a film that just kind of lets you off the hook. So it has like a conventional sort of structure to it, but it's not a crowd pleaser necessarily, the way a lot of sports movies are.
Yeah, I feel like it could have turned into a crowd pleaser, but I like the twist at the end of like, oh no, it's not a crowd pleaser.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that Spike even made a comment about that, saying that the reason that he couldn't have Denzel, you know, get pardoned or, you know, for the deal to come through is that then that would be sort of a suggestion that there was a redemption or something, and that he didn't want to let people off the hook like that, and I appreciate that. Obviously Spike's, you know, inspiration was a little basketball documentary that came out a few years earlier, a movie called Space Jam.
God, Space Jam. I saw a couple times as a kid, and I tried to rewatch it in college, and about 10 minutes in, I had to leave the room, because I was like, no, this is garbage. This is just complete garbage.
It sounds reasonable. I've never seen Space Jam ever. But Hoop Dreams, obviously, is the film that Spike was a fan of, and he appears in the documentary at the Nike camp at one point, saying basically with a theme of he got game is, or he tells all the prospective basketball players, you know, nobody cares about you. You know, you're only here to make the team. You know, their school gets money if you get recruited. This whole thing revolves around money. So even, you know, at that stage, he was, you know, despite being a rabid NBA fan, he was obviously, you know, very aware of what he considered, you know, the exploitation of athletes in college and the whole the prospect mania and everything like that. And at one point in Hoop Dreams, we even hear the John Turturro from Do the Right Thing on the radio when they're playing, you know, his hate-filled monologue gets played on the radio at one point in that movie. But there are a lot of scenes from Hoop Dreams that he kind of carries over to this, too. There's Arthur's dad, you know, shows up at the basketball court and then wanders off to buy some drugs, you know, after missing his slam dunk, you know. Seems like a very early version of the Denzel character. And then, of course, they end up playing one-on-one at the end of that movie. There's a line that Williams says at one point in Hoop Dreams, talking about his brother, who's the failed basketball player, who's always kind of trying to give him advice. He says, seems like everybody I know is my coach, you know. Sort of the Ray Allen character has that sentiment throughout this film. So I think Hoop Dreams obviously was a big influence, and, you know, again, a film that Spike was already sort of involved with by appearing in the movie, so it kind of makes it an interesting comparison. You guys seen Hoop Dreams?
I've seen parts of it, but I've never seen all of it.
It is a 3-hour movie, so
yeah, I'm daunted by the length.
Yeah. So the Denzel and the Ray Allen stuff in this film, I think, is what works, mainly their relationship. Let me ask you guys, what subplot in this film does not work for you?
The Rosario Dawson Lala.
Oh, really?
No, that part works. I think the one that doesn't work for me is Denzel and Mila Jovovich.
Yes, yes, that is exactly it.
I kind of forgot that was in it until I saw the name of the credits. But I mean, the stuff with Lala, I get what it's going for, but it's just kind of it veers a bit into just blatant sexism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the problem with it. Like, I think this as a story point, it makes sense, but it's not. The way she plays it out is not having any redeeming qualities to her character. And at the end, they kind of like try to shoehorn in like, you told me to get an abortion, you know, like, but he even caps that off with like the sex scene where it's like, I want, you know, you can do whatever. I'm not going to have a baby. So it's like, oh, but it was actually her manipulation anyways. Like, come on.
That was
seeing the Rosario Dawson in the role like this, like, oh, this. I'd rather use someone else because she's so talented and it's kind of like, I mean, this is post kids, and I guess this may have been like one of the bigger roles she got immediately after kids, which I guess is something. But this kind of still kind of disappointing of like, she's better than this.
That's interesting. I know Lala as a character has like kind of been criticized over the years as being this, you know, kind of shrewish manipulator, horrible woman kind of thing. I understand her a lot more the more I see the movie, at least what he was trying to do with her, having her be someone who just wants to, who kind of realistically understands that once he goes to college, you know, he's going to dump her and, you know, move on and become famous. And she wants to get a little something out of it before he dumps her. You know, she's like someone who's not going to let him completely dick her over in the end. And, you know, I mean, sure enough, we see, you know, when he goes to visit the college, you know, he's jumping into an orgy pretty much immediately. Yeah. So,
And NBA player Rick Fox is very sleazy.
The guy to know, right?
A completely gratuitous sex scene with, like, not college students. Unless they're giving implants to college students. Come on. But, yeah.
I guess that's the implication, right? That they're bringing these women in specifically to bang him, I think is what we're trying to say.
Some perks.
That's how I read it anyway. But I don't know exactly how big the conspiracy Spike imagines the colleges have to recruit hot prospects, but...
I wouldn't be surprised if that actually happens or has happened in the past.
Who knows? It could be. I guess it wouldn't be that surprising. But another reason that I think I like Lala more is because Rosario's role in 25th Hour as Naturelle, where Ed Norton thinks she's the one who betrayed him, you know, sold him up the creek so that he would go to jail. And this role, Lala, kind of informs that character in a way that, you know, that he mistrusts her. And we are all kind of, as Spike Lee fans, are sort of inherently mistrustful of her because she played Lala in He Got Game. So it's kind of a weak defense of the character, but I totally get what you're saying. But for me, the thing that really doesn't work in this movie is Dakota Burns, the Mila Jovovich character. I understand that Spike wanted to have a character who literally sells themselves, you know? It just seems so completely pointless, though, and kind of strange, and sends off weird mixed signals to what we're supposed to be thinking about this situation with her and Denzel's character, Jake. I went from, like, thinking, you know, well, that's just kind of a useless subplot that I wish wasn't there, to, like, it's actually damaging to the film that subplot is in it. One of the things, you know, with Spike is that he has had, like, a very complicated relationship with his own father. You know, Bill Lee, of course, the jazz player and composer who scored his first four films. But then after that, they had a falling out when... Spike's mother had passed away, and then he had married pretty much immediately afterwards. Spike was even said, you know, my mother's body wasn't even cold in the grave before his dad moved on to a new woman, who of course turned out to be a white woman. And the big problem between them came when he made Jungle Fever, and Bill Lee perceived that to be him criticizing his life decisions. So to come back here and have this other interracial relationship between Denzel and Mila's character in a film that's very specifically about this divide between a father and a son makes it really weird to see what Spike's trying to say, because it comes off as this wholesome, almost platonic until, you know, they hook up relationship where there's an understanding and then he inspires her. I guess, you know, I said the movie doesn't get into sentimentality, but it might a little bit with her leaving on the bus at the end of the movie. It's the one. Yeah,
that
the one
felt
wrong
like
term.
A weird. To me, that felt like a weird jump of like, wait, what's happening right now? Like that. That's one of. That's a plot. Like I understand the point of the subplot of like two damaged people coming together and all that stuff, but it's kind of like it was the most by the numbers. And I think it's. I mean, it's also meant to like humanize Jake a little bit from being like. Can you see, flashbacks of him being a, you know, an abusive father who is just trying to get out of the project. I remember with She Hate Me, like half the subplots in the movie is like, this is not the right place for this. This needs to be put in something else.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I get you. But it's funny because we see all this resentment in Jesus because of what he perceives Jake did to his mother, you know, that he murdered her, you know, that he doesn't consider it an accident. Because it makes this whole subplot with Dakota just completely strange because it's so non-judgmental on Spike's part, even though, you know, the rift between he and his own father is because of, you know, well, partially because of this, you know, interracial relationship, or at least that's how Billy perceives it. So that's just throws the whole thing into a weird gear for me, and that's sort of what I consider, like, you know, sort of Spike's strange... strange, but I'm going to say something good about the film, because I did say that I love this film, and I do. For me, the best scenes of this film are... two scenes with Jake and Jesus where they're at the Manhattan Beach boardwalk and they're walking together. At this point, you know, Jesus has made it clear he wants nothing to do with Jake at all. And then Jake kind of, you know, gets on his good side by talking about Earl Malone, you know, and his namesake, you know, the Jesus nickname.
Earl Monroe?
Earl Monroe, yeah.
Yeah, Earl of Pearl.
Earl the Pearl. Well, that's funny, right? Because everyone knows him as Earl the Pearl. That's his famous nickname. But here he has this secret nickname, which was Jesus. And props to Spike for not making a big deal out of the fact that, you know, a pearl is white. You know, like it's a way of the people, you know, in the NBA who are trying to kind of control these players, or, you know, say that it's pretend it's not, you know, predominantly black sport. But still, it's a great scene between them because, you know, he's telling him this, he's kind of using basketball as a way to kind of get back in with his son, with his secret nickname of Jesus. But let me ask you guys, what are some of your favorite basketball player nicknames in real life?
In real life, I gotta follow my favorite team, the Celtics, and I gotta go with Paul Pierce, and that's the truth. And Pierce is, in my opinion, the second best Celtic ever, right behind Larry Bird. Oh, third best, behind Larry Bird and Bill Russell. But the truth, because like, there was a point in time where he was unstoppable.
Joel?
I'm a sucker for rhyming, you know, so Hakeem the Dream, right? Clyde the Glide Drexler.
That's a great one.
That's what I think. You know, I think the one I've always liked is Karl Malone, you know, the mailman. it's just a funny image.
Yeah, there's another one, The Matrix, but I can't remember who it is. I think it's Sean Marion, who he played for the Mavericks when they won the championship with, okay, it was right, Sean Marion, when they won the championship against the Heat. And Sean Marion is famous for having one of the ugliest shots ever. Like, when he was playing, I would, if he is possession to take a shot, I would look away because his form is so fucking ugly. It's so distracting.
Another good rhyming name, Joel, the Hoya Destroyer.
I'm not aware.
Patrick Ewing played for Georgetown Hoyas, so they called him the Hoya Destroyer.
Mm.
That's a good one. The one I think you can't go better though than Wilt the Stilt. You know, that's just like so perfect. Although I was talking to Chris Funderburg about it, and he was telling me that his favorite is Joel Embiid from the 76ers, The Process. And I gotta agree, that's a great one. But he pointed out too that basketball players, like, with the great nicknames, it becomes their name, like Magic Johnson and Air Jordan and Dr. J. You know, like, I can't think of another sport where, like, the nicknames become so ingrained with the image of the person. Like, even Reggie Jackson, people don't think he's called Mr. October. You know, it's that seems like a very specific basketball sort of thing.
It's more like a WWE thing, you know? It's like The Rock, right?
Right, right.
I guess baseball used to have some great nicknames. Like in the Negro Leagues, you had Cool Papa Bell.
Oh yeah, those old timer. If you like walk through like the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, there are a lot of terrific old timey nicknames for people.
Yeah, I'm going through the Wikipedia list of all the NBA nicknames, and there are so many that I either forgot or did not know.
Sean Marion is the Matrix. Yeah, did Sean. Say that.
Yeah. Like, who was it? Like Rajon Rondo has a few nicknames, which I've watched him on the Celtics for a couple of years, and I don't remember those nicknames. Johnny Swag. Like, I don't remember any of those nicknames at all.
A great one I came upon that I didn't know about was Bill Milkvy, whose last name is spelled MLKVY, and his nickname was the Owl without a vowel.
I'll take it.
Oh, and there's the first defensive player of the year, Sidney Moncrief, who I named my D&D character after. It was Sid the Squid.
That's a good one, see, Ryman.
Yeah, and he was one of the best defenders ever. Like
he sprays people with ink, I assume.
Yeah. Oh, and Iverson, I got mentioned him because I'm in Sixers country, the answer. I got to see Iverson play once. Yeah. And he was great. And, you know, oh, yeah, I just need to be brought up. Ray Allen is part of the greatest NBA draft ever because that was 96. It was Ray Allen. It was Kobe. It was...
So Kevin Garnett in there?
Kevin Garnett was 94.
Oh, okay, Laura.
Or 93. You had Steve Nash in 96. You had Marcus Camby in 96. You had Derek Fisher in 96. Like, it's just like about four like huge superstars came out of 96.
That was a good year.
Oh, and there's Birdman Chris Anderson. Another good nickname. You know, Chris Anderson is allegedly kind of a creep, but you don't have to get into that.
That name's just going to make me think of the terrible movie, so.
Oh, and Joel, there's an Agent Zero, which is a pretty cool one.
That's trying pretty hard. I don't know about that.
He was number zero, that's why.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Gilbert Arenas, and he...
I don't go for the number-based nicknames. Lazy. Thumbs down from me.
Like, I saw CP3 in there. I was like, nah, that shouldn't count. Thomas Jefferson Bird in this Spike movie?
No. He's in Clockers.
It's not Clockers? Oh.
Yeah, he plays Errol Barnes in that one.
I always thought... Okay, never mind. Yeah, you are right. Clockers was the first one. But I like whenever he shows up in Spike stuff. He's just a really good bit player. He's always interesting.
Yeah, he's always super underrated. Yeah, I love him.
Always, I feel like he's always used just enough. Cause I feel like he's always, you know, a tad over the top, which is kind of his thing. And I feel like that could get greedy. Like Spike knows when to use him, when not to use him.
Yeah, and I like how he plays the same character in Red Hook Summer and The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yeah, are those two movies connected? Or is that just like that same character thing?
Just by Thomas Jefferson Byrd.
Okay. Well, hopefully The Sweet Blood of Jesus is better than Red Hook Summer, because, man, the twist in that movie, what was he thinking?
Of Red Hook Summer? Yeah, that's one of my least that's one of my least favorites.
I like the first half. I think it's, you know, fine, and then it's like, hold up, this changes everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Joel, we're going to get to Red Hook Summer, and it'll be an interesting discussion.
Sure. He was also in Girl 6 as a voice, and then Get on the Bus before. He got me. Or he got game. He got somebody.
Yeah. When I think of him, I always think of Bamboozled, because he's the guy who is willing to sell out his own race just for success.
I am also willing to sell out my own race for success.
Yeah, and he does a tribute, which it's a reference to, I think, White Christmas, the Bing Crosby movie, where he does the blackface routine as Abe Lincoln. And Bird does that in Bamboozled towards the end, when one of the characters quits the show because he's tired of doing the blackface routine.
Speaking of clockers, this film was also shot by Malik Hassan Saeed, and both movies look amazing. I think he did an incredible job shooting those films, using the reverse stock in the flashback scenes and everything. It's just a really amazing technique. So that's another thing that I love about this film.
Yeah. I guess, like, crew-wise, I would have liked a Terrence Blanchard score, but you know, he can't do every score for Spike.
Oh, well, the use of Aaron Copland in this film is amazing. That's
It's still a great score, just like whenever I was always hoping for a new Terrence score, like he's generally one of my favorite film composers.
Oh yeah, I agree. He's terrific. But being someone who's not like a big music person myself, I don't know that much about Copland. But I just think that the way Spike incorporated into this film is—I can't even like think of a good example of someone who's used music that is so detached from the subject matter so well. Especially in what I'm going to say is the best scene of the film, and one of the best scenes I think in any of Spike's movies, the one-on-one game between Jake and Jesus at the end of the film. The use of Billy the Kid, the Aaron Copland in that, is just incredible. Like, you literally feel like there's that moment where it's done, where Jake is not going to win the one-on-one with Jesus, that you can hear it in the music itself. It has like this kind of like, it kind of slips down into like a different sort of, I don't know the music term. I wish I did, but you can just feel it in the music. Like, you can feel that moment. And reading about the movie, I didn't realize that Jake was supposed to lose that game 11-0, but Denzel refused. He said, "I want to play him for real." And so what you're seeing, that's actually Denzel playing the game and getting 5 points on Ray Allen in that scene. until he obviously, like, you know, is completely kaput. Apparently the next day Denzel couldn't move. But I think that's cool that they let them actually play the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, when you first see Denzel shooting, like, I think it's from a distance, it's like, that's not really Denzel. And then you get closer, it's like, oh, holy shit. He can actually, like, he has like 3-point range.
Yeah, no, but he's got game.
Yeah, like I was genuinely like, I don't know why I was surprised that Denzel could actually play, but I was like, it's just, I don't, but, like, that just adds more to his great performance here, which is just like, yeah, he really put in the work to appear good at basketball compared to Ray Allen, where like he's not, you know, he's definitely not NBA level, but he's playing much better than, you know, any of us could.
Definitely better than me. But I think that's a beautiful scene. I'm a big sucker for father-son themes in movies, you know, especially like estranged relationships. And this scene reminded me a lot of the great Santini, Robert Duvall, who's this kind of bully of a military father, ends up losing a basketball one-on-one to his son, Michael O'Keefe, and you know, just doesn't handle it well, I'll say. But just sort of that moment, you know, where, you know, Jesus kind of realizes, like, you know, he's on his own, that he's, you know, his own man, that, you know, beating his father is meaningful to him in an interesting way.
And it all ties back to the flashbacks of the training / you know, child abuse of him pushing his son, you know, far too hard, which which I assume is probably a little more common than we would like to think. like the like trying to get out of a bad situation by like forcing your kid to be good at sports type thing. I feel like that happens a little more than like they realize, unless it's like the he like he's pushing his son, you know, the like literally pushing his son and like virtually pushing his son. And this is like this very first word I'm trying to think of. It's just
aggressive.
Like, yeah, but also it's like it's just symbolic. Like I don't know. There's just so much going on with this, the flashbacks, and it's all so layered and so thought out. And it's like this works so well.
Yeah, and it's all building to that moment, to that one-on-one match. And like I said, just cinematically, that scene is just unparalleled in films. The use of the music, the way it's shot, it's fantastic. With the flashbacks, I'll say another thing that I really kind of wish Spike had thought out a little bit more when he was writing the script. The murder, the accidental death of Jesus' mother. I don't know. I wish he had thought of like a more viable thing than a person going to jail for 15 years because somebody accidentally hit her head on a counter. Like, you know, I understand that, you know, Jake is having drinking problems and abuse problems, but there's nothing to suggest it's been an ongoing thing, necessarily, that he's, you know, a spouse abuser or anything like that. Seems like a complete accident that he pushes her and then she hits her head and dies, you know?
Yeah, but you were supposed to read into that about the criminal justice system and the treating of African Americans, right? That's something that has in a couple of movies.
That's some to think about, but he definitely doesn't investigate that enough in this film.
I mean, yeah,
I think he just really needs a way to get Jake into prison that Jesus is going to resent him for, and right, killing his mother, obviously, and then that's all tied specifically to basketball again, to, you know, him being too hard on Jesus playing, training him to play basketball. It makes sense. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, you know, to make it like a little bit smoother or a little less cheesy. But I will say there is always a supreme cheeseball moment, even in the best Spike Lee films.
Mm-hmm.
It usually involves a character shouting "No!" But for me, the supreme cheeseball. Yeah.
Like the end of Jungle Fever.
Exactly. And Do the Right Thing as well. But the cheeseball moment for me in this one is Denzel making out with a tombstone when he goes to the cemetery.
That was a little bit much. But then again, if it wasn't Denzel, it would be... It would work.
Yeah, if anyone could pull off making out with the tombstone, it's definitely Denzel.
Yeah, like up until we did his podcast, I liked Denzel, but I didn't like think he was, you know, the greatest. But now, like watching his Spike movies, like, oh, maybe it's like Spike, like, understood how to like use him the best.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, Denzel's, anytime I hear Daniel Day-Lewis being referenced as the most intense actor in films, I just think, like, Denzel's got more intensity in his fucking pinky than I think Daniel Day-Lewis has in his whole body.
Yeah, he also seems like a more fun person to be around.
Well, that too, I'm sure. But yeah, Denzel's great, and he's great in this film. I think it's awesome that, you know, because Spike wasn't even sure he would be able to convince him to do the movie, but the script spoke to him, and he agreed to do it, which I'm sure, you know, as for any kind of success the movie got, it did open number one at the box office that weekend. You know, I'm sure it was because of Denzel's star power. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I think for all the flaws, I think, like, the good things outweigh the bad in this movie for the most part. I think it's a huge topic. It really is a huge topic when you think about it. Just the culture of basketball, you know, in the inner city and in the 90s especially, and the culture of Nike and Air Jordans, that scene where Jake buys the new Jordans for himself, you know, and you can see how they represent, like, freedom and a, like, free expression for him. But at the same time, you can't help but think that, like, you know, this is not a priority for him to be here buying himself new shoes. You know, this is this is like a lavish, flagrant misuse of the government's money that he's been given. And watching those scenes, of course, you can't help but thinking like of Spike's support of Nike, despite like the sweatshops and the pure commercialization of the, you know, the projects, the low income housing, the ghetto. Where they really built up this coveting of these $150 Jordan shoes within, you know, the poor community that really defined a lot of the problems that were going on at the time that Spike wanted to kind of get into. So again, there's just a lot of big ideas that you kind of think about in little scenes in this film. Just basketball as, you know, this liberating, like, positive thing to young black men in the city, but at the same time this exploitative commercialized, you know, circus run by, you know, a bunch of wardens and college deans and everything, a bunch of old white men who are, you know, using these players because they want, you know, money for their college, like Spike said in Hoop Dreams. So it's complicated stuff going on in this film, and I think it definitely, you feel it, and maybe some of it works better than other things, but there's a lot going on in it.
Yeah, it's I was generally surprised he got the actual NCAA coaches to be in it, because like the first few coaches I didn't recognize because I think they retired by the time I started to watch basketball, but like when I saw I think Roy Williams, who's a coach for Tar Heels now, is like, holy shit, that really is Roy Williams. And that's when it all clicked, like, oh, these are, like, the actual coaches. And it's just like, do the coaches know what the movie's about?
Probably not. I'm guessing he did not did not provide copies of the scripts to them.
That's it. And, like, I don't know, it's just interesting that, like, this is, at least the last few years, has become a big topic again of, like, exporting the college athletes by, you know, they get paid nothing and they sacrifice so much, and, you know, like one injury can, like, literally ruin their entire life up until that point.
Yeah, it's scary. It's a big plot subplot in Hoop Dreams. One of the characters who seems destined to go all the way has a knee injury. And it's pretty much like, that's it, kid. You know, like, you know, it's, that dream is dashed because your knee gave out.
So, can I mention one of the problems I had here? If that's okay with you two.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I really like the sister character, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And from Crooklyn. At about the halfway point, maybe even earlier than that, she literally gets banished from the movie by Jesus, who says, "No, I want you talking to him anymore." You know, and sends her to her room, and then she's just gone. And the rest of the movie is spent talking to Jesus about how great it is for him to have been taking care of his sister and all this stuff like that. It just felt like. Are we never going to see her again? Oh, I guess not. Okay. Well, what's Mila Jovovich up to?
I'm with you. I hadn't thought of that, but she is a good character who does kind of get swept under the rug.
Yeah, I think Ray Allen plays well off of her. You know, they play off of it together.
I think Ray's best scenes, some of his best scenes are definitely with her, because, like, there's that. You really do believe like he is an older brother / sole guardian. Though I guess the aunt and uncle are technically the guardians, but they don't seem to care that much about Jesus and his sister. That it's just kind of to his point. See Ray or Raheem, like, oh, you're not the good guy in this.
Apparently, Bill Nunn was pissed off. He had like come up with some. Really good character things to add to Uncle Bubba, apparently, and they ended up having to like move his scenes forward and shoot him like on the first day, so he didn't get time to rehearse or, you know, flesh out that character And Spike was just like, no, that's good. We're good. So.
That whole part reminded me of she ate me with the Anthony Mackie's parents. You know, like, mm-hmm. There's a whole thing going on between Bill Nunn and his wife that we don't really get to see, you know.
Oh, yeah. She
we don't necessarily need to either.
Oh, and she is awful, too. I don't know the name of the actress. Oh, yeah. She plays his wife, but she only has
Michelle Shea. Yeah.
She only has a handful of lines, but she cannot even do the lines. She is incredibly bad. And that,
yeah,
and that
she's
one
reading
scene.
Them off a card.
Yeah, I think that might be why she shows up for the one scene. But who was it?
your mother, my sister, would have said this. Like, okay, come on, man.
So the whole Mila storyline is a strange one. Did you think she did a good job overall?
I think that Mila did a serviceable job. I don't think she was embarrassing. I think that she was forced to say lines like "House of Ill Repute," which I don't think a lot of streetwalkers use that kind of language.
That was really weird.
I think she suffers from Spike's obvious, you know, problems when it comes to writing women.
Yeah, and I wrote down a couple of her lines, and she said, like, "Dick is a cure-all." And it's like, what is that? This isn't like, she's no Isaiah Whitlock with the she thing. Like, it's like, you can't do that with dick. It doesn't work.
Their conversation. I mean, that's like an awkward conversation, but not because of what's going on, but because it's... I mean, he's going for natural reactions, and like it almost feels slightly ad-libbed, but she's reading her lines, and like I like her as an actress, so
I like seeing her in something that isn't her in like leather pants fighting monsters.
You mean like her real job?
Yes.
Don't say that to Martin Kessler.
Well, he's going to hear this anyway, so Martin, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry.
Yeah, Spike, I mean, obviously, you know, if you've seen more than two of his films, Spike's got such a weird attitude towards sex in general. The whole montage of Big Time talking about the traps that are laid out for young black men, HIV, and everything. But, like, the montage is just like these hot clips of sexy nude women, you know, and it's like... Again, I know that's like the whole basketball thing. There are two very different sides to this sort of topic. But it's just such a weird mixed message when he's saying, you know, don't fall for these temptations of this hot, sweaty sex with gorgeous women.
And now one full minute of breasts.
But it's not just gorgeous women. It's like it's white women.
Well, yeah, again, the whole Mila subplot just suffers for that. Just that whole idea that Jesus gets lured to this college with these promiscuous white women, and Denzel finds some sort of redemption with a white prostitute. I don't know. It's not well thought out. Who, of course, he saves right from the street. But at least we got Thomas Jefferson Bird of sweetness in those scenes. Yeah. You know, she's good with him. They have good chemistry as a pimp and prostitute.
Yeah, I think I have more goodwill towards that subplot just because I like Thomas Jefferson Bird a lot. I like when he shows up and stuff. I wish he acted more, but you know, it's fine. He has his own life.
But like the sister, he doesn't get a payoff either. He doesn't come back into the movie at any point.
No, he's kind of disappears because I guess she goes solo and like at some point, or maybe he got busy.
Well, I think we see him. The last time we see him is when Denzel is like walking the street, and we see all the prostitutes going up to the cars and stuff like that. And I think we briefly see him for a second there, but for some reason he's nowhere near Mila.
Right. Mm-hmm. We are reassured that he still exists somewhere in the world.
But the whole. With He Got Game, the whole theme of, like, success and what means to come with success it definitely comes back in a huge way with Bamboozled, which plays it out in a... when this is... I guess you can say this is a realistic movie for the most part. Some of the subplot... I think, like, the meal subplot is kind of only one that's veers into, like, this is a movie where, like, Bamboozled carries the whole success in the plague of what it means to... the plague of, like, the down... like, the bad side of success in a much bigger, more melodramatic way.
There's another part that just does not fit into reality, which is that he had two busty women he didn't finish within a 2-minute time period.
I mean, he got game.
I mean, we're only human. Men, that is. Men are human. Anyway.
Yeah. You know, and NBA player Rick Fox is like, well, have fun.
Yeah.
Well, the scene was in slow motion, you know, maybe. It lasted a shorter amount of time than we were led to believe.
He was acting pretty well in this movie, Rick Fox.
Yeah, he's a real actor now. That's
oh.
His, yeah. He, what was he in?
Shakespeare in Love?
No, I can't remember. No. But he dated the Buffy, who, ain't Faith from Buffy, forgot her name.
Liza Dushku.
Yeah, for a bit.
And that was him acting?
No, he's been in some other stuff. I just can't remember what he's in. Because I have seen him in other things.
What'd you guys think of the John Turturro cameo?
I had a memory of that scene being a lot more extravagant. For some reason, I had a memory of, like, rather than just showing the video that they made, the intro video, I thought that, like, a bunch of cheerleaders came out and, like, did a whole performance. For some reason, I thought it was a much bigger scene than it was. So it was surprising watching it again recently and thinking, oh, but I have a complete mismemory of this scene. I think it might just be that, for the one part, like, he puts so much into John Turturro's mouth that seems like a really broad and obvious take on this kind of a character, but Ray Allen is reacting to him by rolling his eyes and, you know, not really buying his spiel, so I guess we're supposed to be aware that it's an obvious take on this kind of a character.
Yeah.
So that's a scene that I kind of had a memory of being like, this is a ridiculous scene. And for everything in this movie, too, I should mention, you know, all the sort of conspiracy theories that Spike has about recruiting of athletes. The slick-talking agent who wants Jesus to go straight to the NBA predicts Carmelo and LeBron and Kevin Garnett, you know, and a lot of athletes.
Garnett was already playing.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but NBA, on the note, has, I think they stopped that a year or two ago.
Right, yeah, exactly. And it wasn't even a thing up to that point, but a lot of athletes started getting, like LeBron started getting, you know, wooed straight to the NBA straight out of high school. So while the movie, you know, some things in the movie might seem a little broad and obvious and maybe not really based on reality, it did predict some things that actually did come true like that, so.
Yeah. Because I think the first player to do that was Moses Malone in the 80s. And then Garnett was like a decade later.
Did Moses Malone go straight to the NBA? I did not know that.
I think it was Moses Malone. It was someone in, around that time. Okay, but Joel Rick Fox was in Oz, the TV series. He's in Holes, the Shia LaBeouf movie. Well, former guest was on the show Oz, too, in the last season. He's in movie Dope. You know what I'm talking about, right?
What?
And Tume was on Oz.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay, that's not true.
That's not where he was woofing at. He was woofing at Holes.
Okay, that's understandable.
Which Jim Tume was also in.
Oh, wow, jeez. Gotta loosen the collar here.
He wasn't. I'm kidding.
No, he wasn't. I knew that. I'm not sure if he was.
Have you guys read or are you aware of Spike Lee's book, The Best Seat in the House?
Nope.
No.
is one that he wrote about being a big Knicks fan and what basketball has kind of played into his life. It actually came out, I think, just a year or two before he made this film. My favorite part is the section where he runs down some of the more notable basketball movies in history, kind of giving his opinion on it. Obviously, he's a huge fan of Cooley High and Cornbread Earl and Me. Although he claims Paul Winfield is in Cornbread Earl and Me, which I don't think he is. It's been a while since I saw it, but I wonder if he's thinking of Bernie Casey. I don't know how he's getting confused there. But he...
Oh, another athlete turned actor.
Yeah. And then Jamal Silk Wilkes is a former ball player who's in that movie. It was his only film. So maybe Spike was inspired to cast a real athlete based on that. But he goes after a bunch of movies, of course, like Hoosiers, which he calls reconstituting history with mythology in terms of setting it in the 50s. So people can remember, in his words, how warm and fine it was when black folks weren't around, which is like, okay, that's a Spike take on that movie for sure.
I mean, I have heard some takes that Hoosiers is kind of a purports that, like, dunking and being flashy is a, quote-unquote, like, a black style of play that's not as pure as, like, fundamentals.
Yeah, that it's kind of trying to retake the mechanics of the game for white athletes. Yeah, I can see that. I don't know if it's was really what they were going for, but I can see why people would call that. He mentions The Air up there, the Kevin Bacon movie. Which he refuses to see. He calls it out for taking the joke from from Airplane and turning into a feature film, which is fair enough. But specifically, he calls out Rebound, in which he praises Don Cheadle's acting, but thinks that the basketball is all wrong. And specifically, Earl Monroe is a character in the movie, and they show him dunking. Spike says he never dunked; he wasn't a dunker.
I mean, Spike would know. Hill Harper in this, I really like, because I think of the movies we covered and Spike movies I've seen, he's one of the better, like, sidekick characters. Because, like, looking at... I also think, because he just said She Hate Me. The sidekick character in that, played by Q-Tip, does nothing in the whole movie. Yeah, like, he's there for, like, a joke scene where he goes to sperm bank and immediately...
Yeah, he gets the subplot where he has to,
Yeah, for one scene. But, like, Hill Harper in this is actually legitimately funny. Like, I also like his presence, like, and he's noticeably shorter than everyone around him when he's playing basketball.
Well, he's still one of the star players on the team.
Yeah, somehow.
I mean, he's the Spike Lee, like, equivalent, right, stand-in, right?
Yeah, I was thinking that the whole time, too, because, like, there's a scene towards the end where they're, like, reading... I think a letter Jesus wrote them, and you see the other players who are actual NBA players, Walter McCarty, Travis Best, and there's some others, I have to figure out who they are, but where they are sitting on the bench on the normal seat, and Hill Harper is sitting on the top of the bench, so that he doesn't look as short compared to them.
So his head level, yeah. You know, there that scene where Denzel Washington's character first shows up and he's there, Hill Harper's there, you know, and he, like, Denzel basically wins him over by pretending that, like, hey, you got taller, I can tell. He's like, oh, he's so excited, wow, somebody said I was taller, like, really?
I love the seemingly improvised line when Denzel hassles him and as he's letting him go and he just says, you got some money? Denzel also has a nice bit of business when he goes to talk with Jim Brown and the other, whoever plays the other agent, and he has his orange drink right there, and then he, like, you know, turns away from them dismissively and then turns back and grabs the orange drink in one stroke.
Yeah.
That's a nice little bit of business by Denzel.
Isn't that right after he, like, assaulted somebody, or am I misremembering?
I think so. That's after he confronts Lala's family friend.
Oh, yeah. That's right. He's got that guy.
And, like, another guy from Buffy.
Who's he in Buffy?
He's in season 4. He's one of the initiative guys. He's like Riley's best friend.
Oh, that's why I don't remember him.
Yeah.
Yeah, Riley's the worst part of that show. It goes downhill once Riley gets introduced. Ugh. Are you a Riley fan?
I'm not a fan. I don't think he's as bad as a lot of people say he is, but yeah, no, not a fan.
Okay. Joel, we're going to get back to Spike talk pretty soon.
No, you know, I stopped watching when they recast Christy Swanson, so...
Was that a political move on their part? We'll never know.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at some of the cast, Lynette McKee, she shows up again. She is she's this mom. She shows up as Anthony Mackie's mom, and She Hate Me.
Isn't she Malcolm X's wife, too?
No, or that's Angela Bassett.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, who's she? Is it their mother in the flashbacks?
Yeah, she's the mother in flashbacks.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
How do you forget Angela Bassett? Come on.
Listen, I've watched, like, 3 movies since we watched Malcolm X. Come on, that's that's a lot of information.
Yeah, but still Angela Bassett. Come on.
You watched 3 movies, but they were all Angela Bassett movies, so what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know how.
Hey, Bassett.
Okay. This is just like the last episode with like Mbete. I'm not sure what the right way to say it is.
I mean, until we talk to the actress ourselves, I don't think we're ever going to figure it out.
Yeah, I've always known it as Bassett, but that's just me. I have no idea either. I have no authority.
Okay.
Nor am I authority on Critters 4, her finest film.
She's in that?
Oh, yeah.
That's a shame.
Interesting. Okay, so...
She's also in the terrible Wes Craven violin teacher movie Music of the Heart.
Oh, the late 90s one?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's had some good roles and some bad ones.
Yeah.
But the scene where Denzel punches Riley's friend from Buffy cuts into the great Public Enemy KRS-One song Unstoppable, which is a fantastic song on the soundtrack.
Oh yeah, the soundtrack with Public Enemy is pretty great. And like it feels a bit emotionally manipulative, but I kind of don't mind it, because like Spike is kind of bad. I'd say bad with being emotionally manipulative with his movies at times. Like Malcolm X has the moment towards the end with Giancarlo Esposito with a doll, which is kind of one of the better ones. But then it's like Red Hook Summer kind of ends on that, which it won me over slightly because like the song was so good. But but in general, like he kind of relies on like some on just like a cheesy emotional thing just to kind of rope you back in at some point a little too much.
Yeah, I could see that. I know what you're talking about. I think it's cool though that the end credit song that they sample For What It's Worth with the title track. You know, because you kind of think that's a song that a lot of people think of as being, you know, a protest against recruitment, right? Sort of how this film is a protest against recruitment. Even though technically that's not what wasn't the meaning of the song when they wrote it. But it was great that he got Public Enemy back for this. This is their first recording, I think, in like 3 or 4 years. And the last one they did with Def Jam before they left. And so it has that sort of that nostalgic sort of time capsule sort of, you know, element to it. So, like I said, the Aaron Copland stuff, I think, is really the great use of music in this movie, but I like the Public Enemy stuff a lot.
Yeah, I think Did he use Public Enemy after? Public Enemy is on Jungle Fever. Mm-hmm. Is on here, but did he use Public Enemy in between them?
Not that I can think of.
The only other, like...
I feel like maybe there's a song in Crooklyn or something I'm forgetting about, but like nothing that that's coming to mind.
Maybe, because like the only other like major artist who contributed to like Spike movie I can think of is Prince on Girl 6.
Well, Stevie Wonder on Jungle Fever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot he did the title song. Hmm. But yeah, Public Enemy kind of... I don't know, I feel like they kind of fell. You go.
Oh, I was just going to say, also Michael Jackson wrote a song for Get on the Bus, right?
I honestly don't know, because that's one I've been... I want to watch cheaply, but I kind of will have to pay for
pay for a DVD. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always thought of He Got Game as the first one that he doesn't act in, but I guess I don't remember him being in Get on the Bus, which came right before this, so that might have technically been the first one.
Yeah, it's kind of like odd not seeing him in it. Oh, he's in She Hate Me towards the end, in the like interviewing people on the street.
Yeah, no, he comes back and acts in movies, but I think it wasn't until Get on the Bus that he was not in it at all. Yeah, he's interviewing people in Summer of Sam also.
That's coming up in this summer, actually.
I like that one a lot, too.
Oh, interesting.
The Summer of Sam is coming up.
Yeah, we got Gina and Ben Sunday for that one. I don't really have much else to say besides, you know, it's a... Oh, I remember. So, the Spike thing of overlapping VO with Reading Letters comes back, and I think it, like in this one, I watched this over a week ago, so I might remember things wrong, but I think it goes between like Denzel to Ray Allen to like Young. I think it's a third person, and like it switches between the VO. It's just really interesting, like, beautiful way to, like, this new way of him using that thing.
Where else did he use it?
Malcolm X, there's a part towards the end where Malcolm sends a letter back home, and here, at first, Malcolm is reading it, and then it switches to Angela reading it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think She Hate Me has a moment of switching VO, of someone reading a letter.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, like it comes up from time to time. I don't remember it in Bamboozled.
See, I find it kind of like, at least in this movie, I found it kind of clunky because, I mean, this Ray Allen reading the letter is probably the least acting that they, you know, were coaching him on, because I mean that's what he's doing. But like the other person who's, you know, it's Denzel writing the letter or whatever else was going on there, and that's like hearing the two voiceovers dueling was a little weird.
Well, it goes back to the relationship, though.
Your face goes back to their relationship.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I understand. I don't. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and they're like little. I think that's when you see them, because there's a whole lot of juxtaposition of them in different locations of Ray Allen at his home and Denzel at the sleazy apartment, and they're doing the exact same thing of like bouncing a basketball between mm-hmm. their legs while sitting down, and like it's just a lot of like, you know, they are the same person in certain ways, but they, you know, can't coexist with each other for obvious reasons.
Yep.
What do you guys think about Jesus' decision at the end to attend what they call it, Big State in the movie, the one that Denzel wants him to go to?
Oh, because Ned Beatty wanted him to go there.
Right.
Because, yeah, we should have mentioned Ned Beatty's in this for a little bit.
Yeah, he doesn't stand up.
No. He's like the Woody Harrelson from She Hate Me. He was probably there for maybe a day.
Yeah. I was thinking of also John Turturro, and this is like him and She Hate Me, where it's like he's just a side guy who just shows up for like a scene or two.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we had to get John Turturro in there somewhere. He's a mafia boss.
He doesn't have much to do in Clockers either. He's just kind of hanging around in that movie. That's hard to kind of tell his part.
But the decision at the end, I like it overall because it makes for like a better ending in a story, because then it's like the twist of he made a decision seemingly on his own, and his father, not because of his father, but because it was his choice, and you know, the reveal of Dead Baby being like, well, it wasn't you, so you're going to stay in prison. Being like, so I think it makes for it a better, more... Because realistically, I don't think he would have gotten a lenient sentencing after that if Jesus decided because of him. Because I think the whole thing of like systems being rigged goes into what could you know what I'm trying to say?
It continues.
Yeah, I think that's bullshit.
I like though that's, you know, with his name and everything, that there's sort of the religious connotation that, you know, it's a charitable act on his part. You know, it's. The narrative's kind of covered its bases by having him point out that, you know, it is one of his top schools, one of his top picks, but he's definitely doing it for Jake, you know. So I like that kind of comes around to that.
I always had seemingly he chooses on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Like
chooses in the sister too, you know, like there's school there that she's going to be going to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you could read it as either his father or the sister, or for both reasons. You know, it's left up in the air. We're not there for a decision. Oh, the end shot of like the magical realism.
What do you mean?
Where he throws the basketball.
Yeah, he actually did that. It wasn't a fantasy or anything.
So you're saying Denzel really threw the basketball from the courtyard into the basketball court?
Yep.
Okay, never mind. I have no questions about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been established he can throw really far, Spencer.
Mm.
All right, fine. He can throw really far.
It's well established early in the film.
And didn't you watch through the credits? At the end, somebody shows up in a cell and is like, we've seen you have powers.
It was Nick Fury.
Yep.
He's like, I thought you were on the radio.
I'm just like, holy shit, Sam Jackson back in a Spike Lee movie. This is so exciting.
kicking the shit out of me in an alleyway. Oh, wait, that's a Mobetta Blues.
He's an Old Boy. You know Spike's best movie.
I had forgotten that he pops up in Old Boy. There's only one scene of Old Boy I remember.
Does he play the squid that he eats? Oh wait, does that happen in that movie?
I don't remember. He plays the sleazy apartment guy.
Damn! Get me out of your mouth.
I believe he has white hair in it. Like dyed white hair. It looks kind of silly.
Well, that's Mr. Jackson for you.
Yeah, we'll
he
get
makes some choices.
We'll get the Old Boy. I'm not looking forward to it.
Wait, is he playing Mr. Glass in Old Boy?
He had crazy hair. It's kind of all I remember in some other scenes.
He's playing what is it? Formula 66 or what is that? Do you know what guys I'm talking about?
Mm-mm.
There's some other movie from the 90s where he's got crazy hair.
Yeah. Also, Elizabeth Olsen is in it, and she's good.
That's the one scene I remember.
Yeah, she's always a treat.
Yeah. Going on a gross tangent, I knew of He Got Game in high school for certain scenes.
Oh, you wore out the tape?
I mean, well, the internet. because I liked Rosario Dawson a lot at the time. Well, I still do.
It's like that the one of the first movies you suggested for Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, Doppelganger. I was like, yeah, I knew that movie for certain scenes.
Yeah, that's also a really interesting movie.
Interesting is a word, all right.
Have you seen Doppelganger, John?
Doppelganger?
Yeah.
With Drew Barrymore?
Oh, yeah, I have seen that movie, yeah. I was thinking about the Kiyoshi Kurosawa film.
Oh no, I'm talking about
movie. The Drew Barrymore one, yeah. I have
and,
seen that
one. And Joel's buddy, Danny Trejo, is in it too, briefly.
That's right.
Yeah. I didn't talk about my friends.
Yeah, didn't you meet him once?
No, I've never met him. Sarah's stepfather has met him.
You told me you met him once, and I asked him. I asked you, did you see his Lady of Guadalupe tattoo? You didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, because I was lying.
Okay.
I also have never watched a Spike Lee movie.
All right. So that feels like the end. He got game DVD. It's streaming a bunch of places. I would like to just get like a Blu-ray update because the DVD quality is could be better.
I think it's interesting that I asked you if it had commentary because the copy of She Hate Me I have has Spike Lee commentary. It's like, well, this is one of his better or more appreciated movies, you know, thought of in a better light, but it just doesn't have it, huh?
No, it's a trailer, and that's kind of it.
That's too bad.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, Travis Woods, I'm sorry you couldn't be on this episode. It was taken a long time before you told me about it. Because he wanted to do this episode a week
Travis.
Yeah.
I feel bad.
Well, Travis has Black Klansman, which will be an interesting episode because I have some strong opinions on Black Klansman. But
the more I think about it, the more I do too.
Yeah, we'll get Black Klansman at some point at the end of the year.
I would have gladly switched over to Sucker Free City if Travis had wanted me to.
John, do you have any other 1998 movies?
Yes, I do. I initially wanted to go with, you know, a sports theme, but the only two other sports films from 98 were Basketball and Air Bud Golden Receiver.
I like
the best.
I like best Basketball. That's a funny movie.
I do like Basketball. You know what? But the moment that Chris and I like most in that movie is actually an outtake that doesn't make it into the film. It's Trey Parker gets to the back of a cab in, I don't know, Micronesia or some third world country, and says, "Driver, I'm in a hurry. Take me to the place where children are being exploited." I'm not going to miss an opportunity to recommend to everybody Last Night, the Don McKellar film from 1998. It's a little end-of-the-world drama, apocalyptic drama with Sandra Oh, Sarah Polley, Genevieve Blushold, and David Cronenberg in his largest acting role. Greatly underappreciated film. It's terrific. So that's one that I would recommend people see. Another great 98 movie is Bullet Ballet by the great Shinya Tsukamoto, which sounds like it's going to be a heroic bloodshed film based on the title, but is in fact a Tsukamoto film about his girlfriend killing herself, and he becomes obsessed with guns and in his awkward way tries to go hang out with a bunch of gangs who have guns so supposedly he could get a gun and kill himself as well. It's sort of the classic batshit insane melodrama that he is well known for. The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit by Stuart Gordon is a fantastic film nobody talks about because it's one of his non-horror movies, but it's terrific. It's written by Ray Bradbury and has a great cast.
Wait, the screenplay was?
The screenplay, yeah. It's based on a story, and Bradbury adapted it to the screenplay. It's an excellent story set in Los Angeles about a group of friends down and out Los Angelites who decide to buy a suit together and share it. It's a magical white suit and makes their dreams come true over one night. So,
Boy, that's I'm looking at the poster here. Joe Mantegna, Ezi Morales, Edward James Olmos. There's a lot of mustaches going here, and I think that's Clifton Collins Jr. before he was anybody.
CCJ, that's right. I got to interview him about the movie over the phone.
That's crazy.
He's a sweet guy. Very nice dude.
Interesting. All right, and it's not the episode where Joel and I recommend a 98 movie, but since you're here, John, and you know a bit about this director, Dr. Arkadji came out in 1998, the Emma Mora film.
Another excellent movie, yeah.
Yeah, it's of his late era stuff. It should be more well known because the Eel won Cannes, and the one after that, Warm Water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of gets more attention for being like his final film. But I guess he did the 9/11 documentary thing. Yeah, segment.
The short film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Dr. Arkadji is this. Like, if you want to see his, like, classic Emma Morris, like, a lot of the tropes of, like, inappropriate parent-child relationships, poverty, I should have reread my review on Letterboxd, but, like,
all my favorite things.
Yeah, but covers, like, a lot of the classic Emma Morris stuff, and it's really funny and kooky and weird, and it has a very and animals, because he has a weird thing with animals, and it all comes together, and it's a very weird story about syphilis and World War II.
Yeah, what I like about those final three films that he did, starting with The Eel, is that they're all sort of about these groups of outsiders getting together, kind of these eccentric guys, characters coming together in a weird way, sort of forming this makeshift family unit, and something that I really enjoy about that film.
Yeah, my favorite scene of Dr. Arkadji, well, is the final scene, which I won't say because I want people to actually see a movie because it's really good. But besides that, is the nurse who Dr. Arkadji picks up, who was a prostitute beforehand, gets a note from her baby brother, and you hear the VO of the baby brother reading the note, and he says, like, please. Please be a whore again. We're tired of shitty food. We want good food.
Yes.
Joel, I think you'll like this one. It's not as outrageous as The Pornographers, but still definitely like in the ballpark.
Mm. Probably.
Yeah. It's not as upsetting as The Pornographers.
Well, it takes a special sort of something to be as upsetting. I mean, that's the magic of that movie, is that even though it deals with some crazy kind of like upsetting things, I can't help but laugh thinking about it because it's so like, what the hell?
That's Emma Mora for you. I'd also say that only recently, after Jonathan Demme passed away, I saw Beloved for the first time. Mm-hmm. His 1998 film, which I always just sort of wrote off as, you know, oh, that's Oprah Winfrey vanity project. It's actually terrific. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Definitely deserves more respect than it gets.
Yeah, I thought of doing a Samuel Jackson special, but there's so many other specials planned. That's kind of, this is kind of just too much. We don't have enough time for all. It's not Kurosawa where we have plenty of time with over 30 movies.
Oh, Spike Lee's got what? He's got a ton of movies.
He has documentaries too. And
are you guys doing the documentaries?
Yeah.
And we might do a documentary special and maybe some of them, but yeah.
Yeah, kind of try to cover all of them in one thing. And then there's Original Kings of Comedy, which an upcoming guest is on his Prince-themed podcast, and he said it did come out in theaters, so you probably should discuss it to some degree. Which, I mean, he has a point. It did come out in the theater.
Yeah, I remember it being in the theater.
Yeah, this guest lives in England, and he saw it in a theater with four people, and then they left, then three people left, and it was just him.
I've had that happen to me.
Anyway, so that's it. John, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, guys. Can I just ask, though, like, where would you place this one on Spike's filmography? Obviously, you have conflicted thoughts about it like I do, but like, would you consider it one of the great ones, or middle ground, slightly lower? What would you say?
I would say lower great ones. It's no Bamboozled, which is a carved out place in my heart, because that movie is something special, even though it's a giant mess, but I kind of love that movie to pieces, and this doesn't quite reach that level, but Ray Allen and Denzel, this kind of really lift this movie up into, like, oh no, this is definitely upper tier Spike.
Yeah, I think, like you were saying in the beginning, it's got a lot of what makes Spike Lee good, and it's got a lot of his misfires in there too. So it's kind of a shot down the middle, but it's aiming towards the upper part, because I still think it's a good movie with just some things where it's like, yeah, you didn't need that.
Yeah, that's fair.
So. When it comes to the ones we've covered, it'd be Malcolm X, He Got Game, and then She Hate Me. We haven't got that far in the list yet.
I'm glad it's above She Hate Me, at least.
just barely. You know, that's a great movie.
Sure.
Great. In terms of basketball films.
Oh yeah.
Where would you put this one?
In terms of basketball films,
I like it more than Love and Basketball, because Love and Basketball, the guy plays for the Lakers, which I was on board with that movie until he was on the Lakers. Like, nope. Nope, you lost me.
I can't even think of other basketball. Like, I've seen Hoosiers, like, yeah, but I saw it when I was, like, in high school, so.
White Man Can't Jump.
It's better than Space Jam.
Most things are.
Yes, that's true. I have not seen White Man Can't Jump.
I watched it in high school, and at the time, it didn't click with me. I'm sure I like it more now.
I have seen The Air up there. It's better than that, too. Although I do like Kevin Bacon.
It's better than Juana Man.
I'll have to take your word for it.
I forgot that movie existed.
Also, what is it? The Sixth Man? Is that what it's called?
The Sixth Man. Like Mike is another one. Yeah. Did you guys ever see the Dr. J movie, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh?
No.
It's better than that one.
Air Bud? You were talking about Air Bud. How does it compare to Air Bud?
To the Air Bud, the original Air Bud we're talking about. I like it better.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Joel, don't you do space stuff with space mummies?
Space mummies. Whenever I can, I do space stuff with space mummies.
And their space butts?
And their space butts? Is that what you said?
You heard me.
No, I don't know. Leave their space dingus out of this.
I said butts, not dingus.
Well, that's what I mean when I say dingus. I know that's not what people usually mean, but when I say it on the podcast, that's what I mean. Yeah, if you want to hear me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies, I have a podcast with my two co-hosts, Aaron and Sarah, called Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space, where we talk about science fiction and fantasy movies. And we go through the plot, or we don't. Sometimes we just talk, you know, with the more popular ones, we just talk about what we like, what we don't like. But we're really just trying to have fun conversations with them. Most recently, speaking of space mummies, a movie called Time Walker just came out, or the episode just came out. That movie's from 80-something. And it was, you know, a piece of crap. But we like to do random movies, and that was the one that came up. So it keeps us in fresh material. And coming soon, Probably by the time this episode drops, Clash of the Titans, the original, will be out. And, you know, I love me that Harry Hazen. Love me that, what's his name? Oh, man, what's the name of the main guy?
Laurence Olivier?
No, not him. Not Zeus. Harry Hamlin, that's it. Ah. Yeah, and his weird nipples and...
When are you going to have John and Chris on for Ghosts of Mars?
I mean, if we ever have guests on it, you know... Wait, what?
Because last time, during the Redbeard episode, we talked a lot about Ghosts of Mars for some reason.
Those two movies are related, obviously.
Yeah.
Red Mars, Redbeard.
Okay. Continue.
Red Skeleton.
Alright. Alright, John, do you have any stuff coming up Pink Smoke-wise?
I'm going to be delving into 1990s stalker movies this summer. It's going to be my big thing on the Pink Smoke. I'm going to try to talk about as many as possible. For those who aren't aware of what 90s stalker movies are, they're films like Sleeping with the Enemy and Single White Female and Fear, the Mark Wahlberg movie. There are an amazing amount of them made between 1990 and 1999. So that's where my head's going to be. One? The Crush, yes. It's another of the classics. So I'm going to be delving into that and sort of revisiting the politics of that subgenre and just kind of talking about what an interesting era it was for stalker movies at that time. And then we always have... two podcasts a month, one about genre fiction and one about new movies. I'm going to be talking about the new Godzilla movie in our next episode, so that'll be coming up as well.
Yeah, it comes out pretty soon. I didn't realize. For me, I cite Jailhouse 701, Johnny's Cult Cinema. I'm halfway through the Chiba Checkup Volume 2. Just did Shogun's Ninja. Only watch it if you're a Sonny Chiba fan. If not, there's not much else for you. It's good, but it's more for fans. It's more like if you're a fan already. Coming up, I'm doing Sister Street Fighter and closing out with Wolf Guy. And
Joe Bob Briggs just showed on The Last Drive-In. I saw it for the first time.
I saw that. Yeah, so I'm definitely this Chiba Checkup is definitely a little bit better than the last one, and last month I was on FlixFinds Canada talking about my favorite living director Mohamed Salah Haroun with A Screaming Man and Sex Okra and Salt and Butter, two really good movies. It's Haroun. I can talk about Haroun a whole lot. And I might do a Haroun episode, even though I kind of talked about my favorite ones with with Martin already. So, maybe. And, I think that's it. So, next episode is Eternity in a Day. I think the Mbete special episode might be out around this time. Might come out the same day as this. I'm not sure. And June will be kind of a Billicon themed month with Gontran Hess, Losing Ground, and The Sweet Blood Jesus. And, that's it for now. And, John, thank you for your time.
Thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure.
And we'll see you next time for Eternity in a Day.
Bye-bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.